What's up, guys? This is Tony Angus. Welcome to Chat Time, where I have a conversation with interesting people about the world we live in and the things that matter to us most. Join me each week for a sometimes fun, sometimes controversial, sometimes enlightening, but always enjoyable chat. Today I'm chatting with Mark Squiz Squirrel. Squiz has a fascinating story of special forces training, living in the Himalayas while working for the United Nations, providing humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip, and returning home to operate a highly successful training company in the beautiful hills north of Melbourne. On this trip to Squiz's property, I got to ride a quad bike down to feed the sheep and cattle. I got to check out the 140 acres surrounding his home and office, and I stared across miles of amazing countryside as we chatted in front of the fireplace. Please welcome Mark Squirrel. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm here with Mark Squiz Squirrel. Mate, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks. Absolute pleasure to be here with your viewers.
No, pleasure is all mine. And you know what? You were highly recommended by a mate of ours, Johnny O'Neill. Yes, I apologise for you you having to be acquainted with that rapscallion. But you know what? He did say you've got to go up there and interview Squiz. And so, folks, I've got to tell you, the thing that you won't appreciate right now is we're in Squiz and Ingrid, Squiz's wife, beautiful home, and we're in Hume Vale, and we're looking out of these glass windows over some of the nicest scenery you'll ever see. So it drops down into a valley and across paddocks, and if I thought that the camera on my laptop would give you a good impression of it, I would turn it so you could see it, but it isn't going to. But maybe we'll wander out later and have a bit of a look. So yours is a hell of a background, mate. Can you give me your sort of biography? Or your, I guess it's your autobiography. Tell me a bit about your background.
Yeah, well, I was born and bred in this environment.
Were you?
I haven't mentioned it, but yeah, just a kilometre down the road.
Is that right?
Mum and Dad just moved out after 50 years only 2 months ago. So
wow.
This is my neck of the woods. And went off to uni. Up in Bendigo, which is actually where you're from. Great place, isn't it?
Outstanding. Now, was it La Trobe then, or was it?
It was changing.
It was changing.
When I first arrived, it was Bendigo College of Advanced Education.
Yeah, that's what I went through.
Then it,
BCAE.
Then it moved on to La Trobe Uni.
Yeah.
So, whilst I was at uni, chose to join the Army Reserve and became an officer in the Army Reserve system.
Nice.
And then when I graduated at uni, I graduated as an officer, and I was realising that although I enjoyed study, not the study part of it, but the socialising part of it, the workforce for me was not really where my strengths lay in the corporate world. So I chose to pursue my interest more so, which I was doing on the weekends, the Army Reserve part of it. Got pretty serious about it and put my hand up to see whether or not I could become a member of the Australian Special Forces, which back in the mid-1990s had two Special Forces units. We had the SAS Regiment over in Perth, and we had on the eastern coast of Australia, the 1st Commando Regiment and the subunit, the two commando companies here in Melbourne. Mm-hmm. So in order So in order to get into any of those organisations, I one needed to go through a really difficult and grueling selection course. So I had no idea how I was going to perform, but I fronted up to it with a lot of uncertainty and fear, but managed to get through it. And then it sort of opened up this whole new world that was the kickstart for me of a career that has taken me across the globe and up mountains. So after doing the selection course, you go into a reinforcement cycle where you are given all the skills to go onto a battlefield and go deep behind enemy lines with a small group of people to carry out a strategic level mission and then return home without being seen or heard. So as a result of that, they're very particular in who they select. And the selection course is specifically designed to break the human body down into its bare basics, so that they find out the true characteristics of that soldier. They're looking for people who are able to make good decisions under pressure, leaders, because with a small group, something goes wrong, your leadership can be wiped out with one single bullet. So everyone needs to be able to step up. You need to start thinking strategically because you're not given routine tasks. It's going to have a battlefield impact. They need people who've got unusually high levels of resilience, both mental and physical, because it's going to be a physically arduous but very mentally confronting environment that you're working in.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is sort of achieved by denying all of the participants any appreciation of what's going to occur over a 2 or 3 week period, denied access to regular food and sleep, and it'll be a constantly changing environment that's physically and mentally demanding right from the start. So,
and so did that include, obviously, they're breaking you down physically, so you mentioned that, but are we talking about incredible levels of exercise, exposure to cold, exposure to heat, exposure to long time without sleep? Are we talking about exposure to a lot of fear, elements of fear?
Yep, for sure.
And trepidation, I guess.
Yep. Dread. No, that there's a number of goals that they're trying to achieve, but they all work in parallel. So, yeah, there's a they're depriving us of all the things that we take for granted here, including food, sleep, and the knowledge of what we're about to do.
Yes.
And that's a bit of a stressor in itself.
Of course.
And it's constantly changing. But they are testing for phobias. So they'll do that by, you know, making us jump off cliffs and go into tunnels at night and, you know, you're doing all this ridiculous stuff. But it's sorting out who's got the ability to get their head in the right space. Mm-hmm. The purpose of the selection course, though, is not to upskill us. That they're not trying to train us at that
part. Sort of away from the chart.
Yeah. They just want to move those into one category who are trainable in this type of environment. And those who aren't, that's fine. No one's failed. If you front up, as far as I'm concerned, you've overcome the biggest challenge, which is getting your head in the right space to say, I want to step into adversity.
Yes.
And that's, you know, with your martial arts background and police background, You see that you don't survive for 1 minute if you don't make that decision that I want to be a part of that difficulty.
Yes, exactly right. You have to, there's people are to be commended for putting their hand up and asking for more challenge.
Mm-hmm. And so from that whole experience and then the subsequent upskilling and being a part of, you know, this robust team of guys who've all gone through this process, you tend to find that you get excited by difficulty.
Yes.
It's not a challenge anymore. Well, no, sorry. I looked at every difficult thing as a challenge that I just wanted to succeed in. And so I suppose after 4 years of being prepared to go overseas and deploy, I had a big conundrum to try and solve when Australia did have its first significant deployment of troops overseas in 1999 when we went to East Timor. Mm. And the 1st Commando Regiment, which 2 Commando was part of, was not selected to go in that very first rotation. So I felt like I'd done the footy training on the Tuesday and Thursday night, but I didn't get to go on the footy field.
Didn't get the game, yeah.
So I worked out a way of getting on the field. I did some homework and found a job as a security risk manager with a non-government organisation called the International Rescue Committee, who was looking for people to go into East Timor.
Oh, wow.
And so only 2 weeks after the first troops arrived, I found myself in there. Not with a weapon, not with a uniform, totally detached from that whole environment that I was part of, but there to complement what they were trying to achieve by providing assistance to the civilians that were embroiled in that emergency.
Yeah.
And there was an enormous amount of satisfaction from the knowledge that I had gone into that environment, exposed myself to a level of difficulty and adversity, but the reward came from the knowledge that I was helping somebody else who was going through it, and they don't have a choice. Now, I had a choice to get up and leave if I wanted to, but they didn't. And I saw in that a huge amount of behaviours that showed me that every human being has got this ability to go through adversity and more. Because remember, I was there not really being attacked and directly persecuted, but everyone there who didn't have the chance to leave the East Timorese fronted up, got on with it. And yeah, there's ramifications. There'll be mental health issues and all the rest of it later on down the track. But the resilience within the community is phenomenal. And it's because it's imposed on us. And I suppose in this current climate, when we're doing this whole elbow thing, you know, we've had a bit of a taste of that.
Yeah.
With COVID. And we probably haven't had a lot of that, except for pockets around Australia where we have the floods and the fires. I mean, that's as bad as it gets. But the whole community here in Australia has now endured this COVID. And it's been a testament to how resilient we are, because here we are 6 months down the track and we've done an amazing job.
I was talking to a friend only recently and I said exactly that on some level everybody needs to pat themselves on the back, because as a nation, Australia has gone, I get it, we need to do these things to keep ourselves safe. So let's do those things. Let's get through this. And by and large, apart from individuals, so there's a small percentage of people who still believe it's a conspiracy theory and, you know, there's all that. And I don't think, I'm not going to buy into that discussion. I don't think that's a discussion worth having. But I'm sorry to stop myself. I can see the city.
Oh, you can. It's popped out.
It's popped out. So how far are we from the city in terms of the crow flies?
35 k's, direct.
So 35 k's in the distance there. I can see the skyline, the cityscape of Melbourne City. And just some sun hitting it through the clouds. And you can see the shapes of the buildings. And it looks just amazing. Mate, I know I'm off topic, but that must look incredible at night time. The lights...
It is nice, yeah. With a beer in hand, it only gets better.
I feel bad for you having to live out here, mate. It's terrible.
Mate, you can come up and mow these lawns.
that's actually a really valid point because you have quite a bit of land.
A bit of work outside.
Well, at least the cows and the sheep keep a lot of that.
They do. In fact, maybe I'll take you down there later on.
Let's do that. I'd love to have a look at your property. So anyway, back to it. Do you find that we are living by and large in a first world where on a day-to-day basis, if people's internet doesn't connect, they lose the plot, where, you know, the coffee urn wasn't turned on when they get into the office, you know, all hell is broken loose, the sky's falling in. And it really takes, doesn't it, a challenge for people to grow. That we must, as a species, almost be faced with adversity in order to find out what we're truly capable of, and then we can grow.
I absolutely believe in that premise, that through we get true satisfaction and growth through adversity.
Yeah.
We think a lot of the times that we're getting pleasure and satisfaction from when we feed ourselves pleasurable things.
Yes.
Like we have the coffee, we go on a nice Bali holiday, we go and for a mobile
shopping.
And we think that all of this stuff, yeah, is what life's all about and it gives us pleasure. But from my experiences overseas, I noticed that there's so many communities that are having a wonderful time.
Yeah.
Because they're not fixated on all of that. They're very happy and content with the very humble, basic lifestyles that they live because they've got the number one thing in their life, which is love for their immediate family and the friends and the community that they live in.
Yeah.
And so that experience in East Timor was my first insight into removing myself from being in a first world high income country like Australia. I've done a fair bit of travel, but most of the time it's to similar sort of demographic countries. And I started getting addicted to it. I came back, got out of the army and just headed straight back overseas with the International Rescue Committee, the NGO that I work with, and moved with them across to Albania, Sudan, and then Afghanistan. And 3 years down the track now, I'm realizing, you know, this is 100% what I want to do with my life. It's so rewarding. And I then applied for a job with the United Nations World Food Program, which is the food aid arm of the UN.
Yes.
And I'm still working with them today on a part-time basis, but continued with them through, you know, numerous countries, West Bank and Gaza, Nepal, Sri Lanka, and then returned back home. But I still do consultancy for them in a similar capacity. So I'm working as a security risk manager. So I'm going forward and building relationships with the police and military who are in charge of the communities generally in a war zone, and building those relationships so that they can help us in times of trouble. But more so, it unlocks the communities that they're either fighting against or that they're protecting.
Yeah.
So if they know our intent, then they'll quite often allow us to get through.
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen by an email. You know, we've got to get in there and get to know them. They've got to build the relationship to the point where they trust me.
Yes.
And as a foreigner there, that's the key. It's not because I'm better than anyone else, but I'm not inherently connected to the dynamics of that conflict.
Does it help that you're Australian and not?
In some cases, no. But yes, but in some, no. So if I'm going into a place where there's Australian soldiers, I am probably going to be welcomed in some places, but I might not be welcomed in others.
Yeah.
So it's got a lot to do with that bigger level politics. Now, we mightn't have soldiers on the ground, but Australia might have had influence on what's going on in that particular region of the world. So I have to be a little bit careful there. But as a whole, no, most of the time, the Aussie passport is the thing that is opening up huge amounts of opportunity for me to engage with people on a very positive front, because they're really, a lot of people love Australians. So,
well, most places throughout the world, and I guess, you know, I hadn't taken into consideration, but you're right. If we consider places where Australians have been called in as a peacekeeping force, East Timor, for example, Solomon Islands, then those places may vary in the way they look at us, because we may be part of the oppression group, depending on how the interactions we've had to have with the locals. So, yeah, I can see that that would be the case, but certainly my experience with travel has been the most people think Australians are pretty all right.
Travel while we can.
Yeah, and I'm hoping that never changes. I'm a little bit concerned. I don't want to get into politics, but I'm a little bit concerned with butting heads with China at the moment and, you know, some of these negative trade deals that are taking place. But, you know, by and large, I think Australia needs to keep its friends, particularly in our region. But we're loved. You know, you can go to places in France where we helped them so well during the war that they have shrines to the Australian soldier in France. Those sorts of, I think we need to keep that. And I would hate to think that we'd ever lose that.
Mm.
So what was your favourite place that you went to?
Well, there's one that, you know, I've gone back to on a number of occasions. So during the Civil War in Nepal, there was a Maoist insurgency there for about 10 years. I came in at the height of the war, which is fortunately sort of at the tail end of it, in 2004, at the end of 2004, I arrived there. And my job, again, with the World Food Programme was to go out and engage with the Maoist insurgents in the foothills of the Himalayas, which in itself, that job description was just amazing, because I'm trekking through for 2 weeks at a time through the Himalayas to find and engage with the right people to open up access to those valleys.
So before you go on, what was your role with the Maoist insurgents? What were you doing with them?
It was pretty much to let them know what we were wanting to do. It was a very cut off, isolated part of the world.
Yeah.
At that time, you know, tourism was really slowing down and technology wasn't there. So it was about getting out there and actually informing them of what we were trying to do as a UN group, but in particularly what the World Food Programme wanted to do. First of all, we have to go in and do assessments and work out if there's a food need. We knew that was in certain areas. So then I would go in and get acceptance from the Maoist commanders before we would come in. And then at times there would be a problem. I'd have to go in and some of our staff were being literally kidnapped and harassed and whatever. So I'd be the one who'd go in and try and put out that spot fire. So that was an amazing experience in itself. But I was watching a lot of people come into this place and take advantage of its beauty, which is inherently its people and the Himalayas.
Yeah.
And of course, every moment I took advantage of that opportunity as well and started trekking and climbing in the Himalayas. And that's where I fell in love with the country, because I started to get a little bit obsessed with climbing and, you know, started elevating myself through the ranks as far as altitude's concerned. And, eventually got to a point where I decided, you know, I'm going to give the big one a crack. So, that in itself didn't happen because I had a boyhood dream of climbing into the thin air. It was because of circumstances where a challenge was put in front of me. Not directly, but I saw it as a potential opportunity, but I didn't shy away from it because I thought, you know, if probably shouldn't be climbing it, I should be doing a little bit more climbing before I go for the big one. But it was very fortuitous because our organisation set a date that they wanted to raise awareness of global hunger on the 21st of May, 2006.
Mm.
Now, the 21st of May just happens to be right smack bang in the 2 weeks of opportunity that a climber has to get on the top of Mount Everest.
Yeah.
And I thought, nah, this is all just happening.
Coming together.
It's like it's now or never. So 6 months later, I found myself on. Now, when I say 6 months, that's 6 months after making the decision.
Yes.
I'm going to climb Everest. The 12 months before that, though, I I've been in country, and I had climbed a couple of other smaller mountains, but I just leapfrogged through and got onto Everest pretty quickly, which was fairly daunting. But when I got on it, realized that if you do your homework, so you do your research, you do your training, and you prepare yourself correctly, then you can you can give yourself a pretty good advantage in you know, these big challenges that, we put forward.
So can you tell me about the preparing yourself physically and mentally for Everest? What would that be like for a guy who, I lived in Colorado for 3 years, and I have to tell you, I hated the cold.
Right.
Hated the cold. I can't even begin to tell you, mate. I just refuse to go back anywhere that's that cold. I just hated it. And also, at the start, when I moved to Colorado, I remember thinking, what happened to the air? Where is it? Yeah. What happened to the oxygen? So preparing to get to the top of the highest peak in the world, what did it require? You'd already done a lot of mental training through your special forces, yeah, and all of that.
Yep.
Was it any different? Well,
no, it was very similar.
Okay.
And because I'd had that experience, I knew my physical capabilities. I also knew my mental capacity to deal with the difficulties.
Yeah.
So that gives you a huge amount of confidence in yourself. You've got to be careful it doesn't give you too much. So I weighed that up with what did I do well during that selection course that allowed me to have success. And since then, what had I also done that had allowed me to learn a bit about myself? And a couple of the key things were making sure that I did every part of what was going to be required on the mountain in smaller segments.
Yeah.
So that none of it was a surprise. So I did a lot of climbing, you know, smaller pitches.
Mm.
I was really comfortable with all of the equipment that I was going to be using. And yeah, I was rehearsed on it, and I was current, and I was feeling, yeah, I can just do all this blindfolded.
I imagine you were familiar as well with the clothing that you needed to wear, yeah, in
getting the
extreme
right
cold, yeah, and sleeping overnight in those bad conditions.
Yeah. So just getting the right kit,
yeah,
and doing the research to make sure that I had the best that I could go with. So getting all of that sorted out, meeting my team, making sure that I was comfortable with who they were, because I signed up as an individual to, yeah, be a part of a wider team.
Yeah.
So getting to know them, getting to know the expedition leader, getting tips off people like the expedition leader who'd been there before. So going to reliable sources,
yeah,
and getting their advice. And yeah, the little things that they gave me, just one obvious one was I did all the physical things correctly. I was, first of all, building my lung capacity by doing lots of cycling and running.
Yeah, well, that's right. I was going to say.
But the problem was that I was shredding any ounce of
fat
that I had on me.
Yeah.
But when I caught up with the expedition leader, you know, 3 months out, he's gone, squeeze. Hey, you're losing weight.
Yeah.
That's a danger on the mountain.
Pack it on.
You've got to back off on the aerobic stuff and allow your body to chub up, because that's going to be your energy source on the mountain. Mm. The higher we get, our body starts rejecting the lack of air. Mm. And the first thing it starts doing is slowing down your digestive tract. It gets to the point where you feel nauseous and you want to vomit. So we knew that was going to occur. So he said, mate, you got to tub up so that you've got something your body can draw on that.
The energy.
On the resource, yeah.
Mm.
So little things like that, surrounding myself by all of that knowledge and people and equipment, gave me this confidence before I even got on the mountain that I was up for the task.
Yeah.
And so from day one, I thought, yeah, if I've prepared myself right, I'll be good to go. And I felt that straight away. Mm. There's a huge amount of unknowns on Everest though, that you can prepare yourself, you can be the best climber, blah, blah, blah.
Really?
But avalanches can fall.
Oh, of course,
you
can, yeah,
fall into a crevasse.
You, yeah, can get your blizzards come through.
There's all of this stuff
you can, yeah, predict.
So that's when it's all about mental. We had, yeah, 11 climbers to start with. By the end of the second week, we were down to 10. And that was simply because someone got psyched out by the crevasses, which is the first part of the climb.
Yeah.
And that's fair enough. There was no, again, yeah, you front it up.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right.
I mean, good on.
You know, you can call them a failure, but I've never been to the bottom. I've never made a decision to start scaling the mountain. So I get it, you know, and they need a pat on the back for getting that far.
Mm.
People don't get rewarded enough for at least trying.
Mm.
Okay, so you didn't you didn't make it to the peak, but damn, you showed up. And they must have done a hell of a lot of training like you did prior to getting there. So they were obviously just psyched out of it. They weren't special forces background or anything
They weren't, but you know what? That's just not the criteria for climbing a big mountain. In fact, I've sort of reflected upon the two groups of people there. I've thought about the team and more widely the group of people who are climbing Mount Everest the year that I was there, and the buddies that I've met through the special forces experience. And I reckon 90% of people who I did my selection course with would climb Mount Everest successfully.
Okay.
But only 10% of people who summit Mount Everest would pass the special forces selection course.
Wow. Okay. So that's an interesting reflection.
Yeah.
And why do you reckon that is?
Because on Mount Everest, it's all up to you and all of your choices are up to you. You're not up against another entity called the beast, which is a human.
Yeah.
And so if you want to retreat into your tent and eat as much as you want, you can do that. And you're relatively safe. Okay, you can still get hit by an avalanche. But most of the time you have periods on the mountain where you can get your head into a really comfortable space.
Mm.
But on the selection course, there is this constant concern about what's coming up next. And it's being driven by somebody else. And if you do one of the things that they are looking for, you're pretty much gone. Mm. So they are wanting you to fail. And it's very easy to take that fail option because it gets you away from this problem that you've got, which is all of the adversity. So
and they spring things on you too, don't they? Oh, yeah. So you're constantly looking over your shoulder and your nerves.
But also, you need to have a huge array of physical attributes and qualities to get through the selection course.
Mm.
So you need to be able to climb, swim, run, pack march, sprint.
Mm.
These huge weights on your back over massive long distances.
And like you said, no phobias around small spaces, high spaces, deep spaces.
Have a mental aptitude, a physical aptitude with weapons. All of this stuff needs to be there. If one or two things is not there, you're gone. On Mount Everest, hey, you got to climb up and climb back down. Okay, I mean, that's essentially what it gets down to.
Yeah,
yeah, okay, I'm belittling the whole experience.
Yeah, I get it.
But what I'm trying to say is that
it's a single slice that you have to do expertly.
Yeah.
Whereas in the selection course, you've got to do all of this really, really well. In Mount Everest, you take a slice of that and you've got to do it extremely well.
Yeah. When it comes to physical stuff.
Yeah.
So this is, I'm not talking about the mental stuff. So when it comes to the physical attributes that are required, yeah, you do feel you need to be physically fit on Mount Everest. There's no doubt about that. But mentally, you can get your head into a really comfortable space.
Mm.
But on the special forces, you've got to have an array of physical attributes and you've really got to be on top of yourself mentally.
Yeah.
Because they're trying to break that apart.
Yeah.
So
I remember stories I never tried out for the SOG, Victoria Police. And the reason was quite simple that when I started my martial arts journey, I was in my teens. And by the time I was in my 20s, I'd been punching bags for so long that I actually damaged my left shoulder to the degree where it had reasonably significant constrictions, particularly to hold anything over my head.
Mm.
And so even to put my arm in that position, it just pinches. And so it's a terrible excuse, but the SOG do a lot of that treading water with the firearm overhead.
Mm.
I can't lift my arm over my head without causing some pain, let alone in water, treading water for a long period of time with a weight there. And that immediately made me go, I can't do that. And I went and saw a surgeon and he said, and this was like 1994 or something. And he said, if you have surgery now, some of that restriction will go, but the general quality of your shoulder is going to be minimized. It may never, ever be more than 80%.
Mm.
So damned if you do, damned if you don't at that stage. I'm sure it's a bit better now, but I remember mates, the guys that I knew who went through the process, and they were running they would run them or drill them or put them through that intense training getting them to a point where they wanted to break and then saying, just leave if you want to. Mm. Of course, you know, there's a bus down the hill.
Yeah.
You can see the bus. You don't want this, do you? Of course you don't.
Yeah.
Think about how warm it is in that bus, because it's probably middle of winter, freezing, could be snowing where they are. And they're saying, if it's too much for you, go down there and somebody will drive you home. Well, of course, you know, you're freezing, you haven't slept, you've been up all night, you're dirty, you're exhausted beyond, you know, probably more than you've ever been in your life. You've had people yelling in your ears, get up, Angus, you dickhead, get up, run, I said run, what is that, don't do that, you're an idiot, have I told you, did you do the, there's the bus.
And then on top of that, though, they've said, you just failed.
Yeah,
so you might as well go on the bus.
Yeah.
So in your own head, when you hear that enough times, you think you've probably failed, so I'll just get out of here.
Yeah. It takes an extraordinary mindset to push through that.
Mm.
At the time when you're most tired, you're most fatigued, you're hungriest, you're coldest, and someone says, you're not going to make it anyway. There's the bus, it's warm. And there's food. There's some Ingrid soup sitting in that bus for you. And you just go, oh, you're right, mate, screw this. So I totally get it. And this is why I think I have such a sort of measure of respect for anybody who goes through that and can get out the other side. And then just to go, nah, that single-minded focus, nah, well, I will make this.
And that's the key thing, is that focus on what it is that you want out of it.
Yeah.
So for me on Mount Everest, yeah, it's about constantly visualizing what it will be like to be standing on the top, raising the flag for the World Food Program on behalf of the 1 billion people who roam the world looking for food. I thought, am I doing it as tough as any of these other people who are looking for food every day?
Yeah, good point.
Of course I'm not. So that visualization was enough to overcome every little challenge along the way. And in the Special Forces Selection Course, it was all about going, do I want to stand there one day and be able to go, yeah, I've got the Green Beret. Yeah, I'm going to do whatever I can, because that's what I want.
Yeah.
And I don't care about all this other stuff in between.
Yeah.
So, but if you lose sight of what you're trying to achieve and, you know, maybe why you're trying to do it, well, you're out. You're on the bus straight away.
Yeah. I think it's amazing. And, you know, the older I get, the more I look back at, in my 20s and go, why didn't you? You know, why didn't you push? Why didn't you? I pushed in a lot of areas, you know, martial arts and those sorts of things, and earned myself world championships and earned myself, you know, sixth degree. So in the art that I teach, so I need to narrow this definition down. I'm the highest rank in the Southern Hemisphere. So what? You know, I didn't bleed. I didn't have to cry to get it. I wasn't freezing. I wasn't being yelled and screamed at. I just trained real hard. But, you know, I look back in my 20s and I admire the people that did, because I'm like, why didn't I push myself to that?
Mm.
Why didn't I take the opportunity to just ask so much more of myself, just to see? Because I know the reason I didn't was the shoulder. But now 30 years later, I go, maybe that's just an excuse.
Mm, maybe. And maybe you did push yourself enough to achieve what you have.
Mm.
But
it's hard to know.
It's you're very right. Opportunities come and then they go.
Yeah.
And if, because I found myself in Nepal with that opportunity, but I would not be doing it now because my circumstances have changed with two kids and I'm living back here. So to now go and do it would be a lot harder.
Yeah.
I was in the environment and it literally was a blip in time in my life where it presented itself and I could have said, oh, I'll do it later. But I would have never done it.
Yeah, that's right.
So the other interesting thing I remember was when I was contemplating doing it, was that I didn't tell anyone that I was going to climb Mount Everest until I made the decision that I was definitely doing it.
Mm.
I discussed it with one or two people to get some more facts, but in the conversation, I never said that I was thinking about doing it. And I did need to speak to my fiance at the time, who's now my wife, Ingrid, because I needed to get her intake before I made the commitment. But once I made the decision, I made it public because that helped me incentivize myself to get the job done, because I didn't want to be one of these people who said, I'm going to do it. And then
don't do it. Yeah.
And I can't stand the thought of failure. So I knew that once I publicly made it, I was on the right road.
Nice.
So I would suggest that that would be a good thing to always think about is don't talk about doing stuff. Only talk about it if you actually genuinely want to do it.
And make a commitment in front of others so that they hold you to it as well.
Announce it to everyone. Because for me, that's all about your own pride. Don't put that pride on the line. Like, if you make a commitment, you commit to it.
And sometimes you can even set a date and announce the date. So I had to announce the date with these podcasts.
Right.
And so, you know, this is not my thing.
Yeah.
I didn't know anything about it. And it was actually a good friend of mine who said, you know, you should run a podcast. You'd be really good. And I waited 18 months. And the only reason was fear. I didn't know anything. I didn't know about it. I didn't know how to start. How do you start?
Yeah.
And then I got a mentor. And part of the program was set a date and announce it.
There you go.
For that
and
reason.
Did that really help you get out of the line?
Of course, because I'm like you. I went, I've set a date, I've announced it, I won't fail. Yeah. I'm not failing. And I went daily in and did the things I had to do and to work forward I did what I had to do. And
how do you feel now about the anxiety that you had before now?
Oh, look, I look back and again, intellectually I understand it, but emotionally I built it way bigger than than it should have been. And we're only talking about podcasting. We're not talking about Mount Everest.
No, but you can have equal amount of stress. It's all up to what's going on in your head.
Yeah, but I think that the analogy, I guess it was an attempt to sort of bring that back to anybody's life where anywhere in your life you can say, I want to achieve something. Regardless, I want to get a degree. I want to learn a language. I want to learn to play the guitar. Don't announce it until you go, if you've made the commitment with yourself, and then make sure you announce it and make sure you give people a start and, you know, some sort of date. Invite them around for Christmas. Here we are in July. Invite them around for Christmas and say, I'm going to play you a Christmas theme on the guitar at Christmas. So that you now
have to.
Yeah, you have to, because everyone's going to rock around and you're going to go, right, get your guitar out, stupid.
Yeah, twang.
Yeah. I had one lesson.
I'm a loser.
Yeah, that's right. So so many of us, there's no way we're going to do that. We'll get out there and plug that thing in and away it'll go.
Mm.
But I think that's really important.
Mm. Spot on.
Mm. So you went then through all of this, doing this humanitarian aid with the World Food Program. And so how did that wind up for you? You just went one day, you know what, I've got to come home. I suppose you were either thinking about being married or actually married at that stage.
Yeah, it was more or less along those lines. So after Nepal got posted to Sri Lanka at the height of their civil war.
Yeah.
Which is horrendous, actually.
Yeah, one of the worst, they say.
Well, yeah, there was not a lot of international oversight in media and stuff like that. So they got away with a lot. It was pretty nasty. So when we were there, we fell pregnant. And it's amazing. As soon as we knew that there was a baby coming, I just suddenly had this urge to get back to Australia. So we did our time, actually had our first child here in Australia, but when we were still living in Sri Lanka, and he came back and spent 4 months with us just to finish off that contract. We returned back home, and it was for a number of reasons. I probably had done my time in the UN and felt like I'd achieved everything I wanted to in the short term, and I realized, you know, at the age of 35 that if I wanted to get back to Australia so that my kids could be brought up in the community and culture that I'd been brought up in, then we need to go now, because professionally I needed to get my teeth into something else before I was getting to a point where it was going to be too hard to set that up.
You have to, once you have a family, your priorities immediately shift.
Change, and my appetite for risk was changing.
Yes.
So I didn't necessarily want to be the guy who was coming in and out of war zones and not really present all the time for the kids. You can't turn that back. So we came home, we bought this property. We've been back now 12 years.
Yeah. And jealous, by the way, just to remind everybody. Jealous.
Come anytime, mate. And, set up a little business that, we now operate from here, and that involves providing keynote presentations, you know, motivational stuff. So 45 one-hour presentations that are normally touching on the storyline that I've just talked about, Special Forces, Humanitarian Aid and Climbing Everest. But bolting onto that story, different principles around working under pressure, teamwork, leadership, communication, a little bit of cross-cultural things as well, depending on what the client's after. We expand that. Could be a half day or a full day workshop where we're going to more detail of that using concrete examples that I've experienced myself to open up conversation about the organisation that they're coming from. And then the sort of third element to it is we sometimes bring those same or smaller groups out to this property or nearby to run simulation training to put people under pressure, which is where this property has become really ideal. It's 140 acres and 20 acres is cleared, 120 is bush, and we create these lifelike simulations to put people under pressure, and they learn about themselves and their team around them as well.
And what sort of perhaps I guess when we go down there you'll talk to me about the programs you've run, but what sort of things are organisations looking to get out of the training? What are they trying to achieve? Surely it's not just we'd like to do a team building day. Is that as blunt as that?
Sometimes it's that basic. They just want to get out of their office and get into a new environment and just have an opportunity to be with each other.
Right.
Not thinking about work. But most of the time, if they're wanting to undertake one of my activities, it's not stuff that's easily designed, so there's a little bit of financial investment, but there's also a huge buy-in from the staff.
Yeah.
And I'll just give this very clear briefing at the start that we need to put in. If we don't put in, we're not going to get anything out of it.
Yeah.
But you actually won't get through the day if you don't put in. So it's going to be physically uncomfortable. It's not a boot camp. We're not trying to break people down. It's not like the Special Forces Selection Course. That would just be ridiculous if your normal job is behind a desk.
But I think the other thing too is people who are going for special forces are preparing before they even get there.
Yeah.
Whereas you're taking people from behind a desk.
Yeah.
The last thing you want to do is have them jump that chasm to, I want you from behind a desk to being special forces. That's just a bridge too far.
That's right. Mm. But the qualities that we're expecting in both of those environments are, in actual fact, very similar.
Mm.
So we're looking for people to be able to have good mental resilience, good team players, good communicators, able to make good decisions under pressure, able to lead at certain times. So there'll be one of those focuses that will be the theme of why we're running it.
Yeah.
And we'll be announcing that at the start, but then I'll go through this process. And the learning really comes later on when we go back and debrief through it and we work out what could have been done a little bit better or a little bit in a different fashion, and then connect that back to the decision-making and the behaviours back in the workplace. So it's a journey. It's an experiential journey, and it's a safe one because no one's expected to be performing beautifully in this work because that's not what they do for a job.
Yeah.
So you can fail here and it's okay.
It's a simulation, but it's as close to real as you'll get being a simulation.
Yeah. Mm. So that's a bit of fun, and we take them out into the hills and they come back a sort of different person.
But maybe now's the time to go and have a look at doing that.
Well, would you like to come down and have a look at the property, and maybe at the same time we can
feed
some animals? We've got some sheep and cows.
Outstanding.
Let's do it.
Well, that was amazing. So going back to the Frontline Global Challenge, where did everybody, was it a boot camp? Not a boot camp, but did they bust in, stayed for umpteen hours and then bust back out?
No, we arrived, it started and finished here. So everyone brought themselves to the start point. And then it was a big scenario brief or safety brief followed by a scenario brief, which started the immersion process.
Yeah.
That was done verbally, but also through a video. So everyone was in small groups or in their families, moved into a tent where they watched a video and they didn't know it, but at the end of the video, they're pushed out of that tent, which is their room, their house, sorry. And that's when it all kicks off. So they don't even sort of know when it's going to start.
And there's no whistle blowing and
no, it's not.
Drop.
get ready in 10 seconds, the race is about to begin. Because it's all of a sudden, you know, they're watching this video, and then the video goes, the room you're in now, the house you're in, it's not tenable. You've only got 15 seconds, you know, the guy on the other phone, you've only, his brother.
Yeah.
I've heard the cops are coming and they're coming after you. You've got to move now. Go. Yeah. Doors open and they're off.
Nice.
So, yeah, pretty exciting sort of start.
So, so they're refugees and from a humanitarian, like you were doing humanitarian work.
No, in this instance, they were in a role of being a persecuted minority group within the war zone.
Oh, I see.
So they were not playing the role of a humanitarian. They were a national of that
group. I see, they're a national.
And they were off. And they were being chased by their own fellow nationals who were a part of the bad guys, which is, in this instance, was it not simulating a particular country, simulating a fictitious country.
Well, simulating something that has happened in many countries.
Yep.
Many has happened. I mean, you can go to civil wars in Sri Lanka and, Somalia and a lot of these places, even go into the Bosnian Kosovo war,
mm-hmm.
and there were atrocities committed there. So, yeah, I can see it would relate to so many places.
Mm. Nice. So, yeah, there was, in that instance, because it was not just about team building, because everyone was, that was an open to the public, that one. So that was more an experience to push yourself through a little bit of physical and mental adversity because of the unknown, and they knew it was going to be physically demanding.
Yeah.
But also just to have a bit of a reflection, poignant moment on what it's like to be persecuted. Because, yes, there is persecution here in Australia. There's no doubt about it.
Mm.
But generally speaking, most people live in a wonderful environment. Yes. There's not. So,
and those of us who do tend to become blind to the fact that persecution still exists.
Mm.
Because unless you see it, unless it's in front of you day to day, you lose sight of it.
Mm. Mm. Well, and we can all see it on the screen if we watch it on TV. We might see it up face to face. But I realised through one experience overseas that you can't truly understand what it's like until it happens to you.
Yeah.
So when I was living in Jerusalem, working with the World Food Programme again in the West Bank and Gaza, so Jerusalem was our hub, but I was moving in and out of the West Bank and Gaza each day. I lived there happily in a neighbourhood called Beth Amina for 18 months. Everything was going well. I knew people in my neighbourhood right next to where I lived. Thought I had a good, great relationship with everyone, the shop owners and all the rest of it. But I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning on one occasion because there was a noise going on outside the house and I didn't know what it was. So I walked out there and the United Nations car that I had driven home was on fire.
Oh.
So I had no idea why, but went to the neighbours, asked him to call the fire brigade. I ran back, grabbed a fire extinguisher, tried to put it out, couldn't do it. When the fire brigade turned up, we'd lost the car. It was destroyed.
Yeah.
Upon inspection in the morning, we recognised pretty clearly that someone had come in and had thrown Molotov cocktails on the front end of the car, gone to the back end, prized open the petrol cap, stuck some newspaper down and tried to light that up. It was a diesel vehicle, so it didn't explode.
Yeah, yeah.
But we got a pretty clear message. There was either this was an assault against the UN as a wider entity, that's why they've gone for the car, or maybe it's against me.
Was it branded UN?
Yeah, yeah. It's got UN written all over it.
Yep.
So I was a little bit concerned because I thought, is this against me or not? Either way, I'm really concerned.
Mm.
The UN more broadly was concerned. So they sent a team out from New York to do a thorough investigation. And 2 weeks later, they came up with their findings. And there was a high probability, well over 90%, that the reason why that occurred was because I had been seen on a regular basis, 2 or 3 times a week, going for a jog in the morning where I'd go across, out of my driveway, down a road by about 100 metres and across the main road. When I crossed that road, I would enter into a community of a neighbourhood where Israelis lived.
Yeah.
I'd go into that because it gave me access to a parkland where I could run around and then return back. On my side of the road, I had limited opportunities. I was living in a Palestinian neighbourhood.
Right.
Which was a safer option for me because I was feeding Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. So I was more in line to that, to being there. I would have thought, well, it was a natural place to be living from that safety perspective. But somebody in my neighbourhood, one Palestinian,
kept walking, running into the Israeli area,
did not agree with the way I was living, because by me running across that road, it was suggesting that I was sympathetic to their enemy. And that wasn't acceptable for them.
What did they mean?
So what they were saying to me was, instead of knocking on my door and saying, I don't like the fact that you're going across the road and you're inside my enemy's territory, they decided to come and send me a very clear message that it's time for me to get out. And I took it. I understood. The message was very, very clear. And it was clear to the UN, and that's why I left that conflict zone.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, the message itself is clear, except when you say, look, I get the car's on fire, and I get the crux of the message is that I'm not wanted here.
Yeah.
That's loud and clear.
Yeah.
The why, the subtleties become unknown, and not wanted by whom, not have I done something to offend, can I make amends? Is this just one? Is it a group of lunatic, on a drunken binge?
It could have been that, but there was a lot of investigation done, and the investigators were told quite clearly through a third party, that this is the message that he needs to be told, because if he doesn't leave our neighbourhood, we're coming after him next.
So my point is, why didn't they? Is there not somebody who could have come with, a thingy on, knocked on your door and just let you know, there are groups of people who will target you because of, we don't think, and you've got to get out of here, and then just leave without, because you needed a team of investigators to come and sort that out. So all you got was this message about a burning car, whereas it could have clearly been just articulated.
Well, it could be, but we're talking about persecution here. And that's what persecution is all about. Is that you feel not wanted anymore.
Yeah.
There's something out there that's telling you you need to change or you need to get out. In this instance, for me, I need to move, which is why we have people moving across this world fleeing from persecution, because they fear for their own life.
And I guess that the point, the difference between the scenario that I painted is that there's no fear attached to that. There's a... I really like your ringtone.
Yeah, thanks, buddy.
Sorry. No, that's wrong. Yeah, so whereas the message that they clearly delivered had that persecution and that fear element, didn't it, and the unknown element. When are they coming back? Is it going to be worse next time? They've set fire to this. What's next? My house? Is someone going to shoot me? So all of those fear unknowns that you were talking about being a huge part of the trepidation we feel. And remember, you liken this back to your special forces training where you didn't know what was happening next.
Yeah.
And so you live in this constant trepidation because I don't know what's coming. So you live in dread almost. So that's obviously the message that they delivered so beautifully, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. No, that was loud and clear, mate.
Yeah.
It couldn't have been clear. Again, it gets back to that Aussie passport. I had the advantage of having that in my back pocket and being able to leave. And, that's our global right, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right, because you could have been from somewhere else and just been.
Well, you're stuck there. If it's your own home country, then you can't actively go and just be
in the middle of the fight forever.
Yeah.
Where do you think you might be taking the business further? Are you looking to expand? Are you, and maybe tell the listeners, what if they were to contact you, what are the sort of things that you want to be known for?
I don't know if I want to leave a legacy, but what we do here is, the presentation. So we come in and do the 1-hour presentations, workshops, and those outdoor team building activities. But we also recently recognised that we've got to keep up with the technology of the world, and we brought into our business this virtual reality technology, and we've incorporated that into our training. So
nice.
If we're doing a workshop, we'll pull out 30 sets of VR and immerse.
I noticed you've got some equipment down there, actually.
I do just happen to have some here for you.
How lovely. Here's one we prepared earlier.
But we immerse people into the environments that I've talked about previously about being overseas, and put them into some difficult hotspots and ask them to sort of problem solve what they do under those circumstances. So
So this is an immersion training. You stick their heads on and make them feel as though they're there.
Yeah, and this is just a compliment to the workshops. Instead of watching me recreate the situation through a PowerPoint presentation using video and photos, we ask people to stick these on and get themselves in the moment, gets the heart racing, come out, take these off, and then we get into what did you see, what would you do, give me a decision.
And there's an instant emotional buy-in, isn't there, with that sort of thing? When you can be immersed in a scenario as if you're actually there. And so these are 360, you can turn them and get 360 vision?
Yep. We have uploaded them into an app. The phone goes onto the front of the screen.
Oh, the front, yep.
This has got all the working parts are inside the screen. So you're actually looking at this, but you are feeling as though you're in a 360 theatre.
Yeah, right.
So you're turning around and you're seeing, you know, the door there, turn over here, see the other door over there. So you're present.
You record the 360 on some of these other devices.
Yeah. I've got some of it from being overseas.
Yeah.
But we do actually offer for some organisations the opportunity for us to come in to their workplaces and we mock up some scenarios that their staff are likely to face.
Oh, yeah.
Using these 360 cameras, we film it and then we use that as a training aid inside the goggles. So this is a camera that's just got two 180 degree fish eyes.
Yeah, right. So each one of those does 180 degrees.
Yeah. Up and down and around. Then we come back, stick that into a computer and it connects the two bits of footage that's been taken. That's what gives you the severe.
Yeah.
And with this, you can carry it and get rid of the stick. So you feel like you're literally a fly on the wall walking with the action. If we want a little bit of better quality, then we pull out the Big Daddy.
The Big Daddy
version, which has got six cameras, and they're only taking a smaller portion of the overall 360.
So for the audio listeners, I'm holding what is about a 5-inch diameter black metal sphere on a stand. If you imagine a black metal globe, it looks a little bit like the Death Star in Star Wars, but it's got six tiny little cameras poking out around its the middle of its sphere. And so they take a section.
Yeah.
Each camera takes a section. Wow. And so that would make that clearer. And that, and again, that plugs in and stitches all together. Brilliant. And so when you put, and so that downloaded footage, that 360 degree footage, goes onto the app on your phone, which plugs into these. And then when you walk around, when you turn, you're getting the image that the 360 camera's taken over there or up there or around there at the same time, to my left or right or up or down. Yeah, so it's amazing. And look, I'm a big fan of this. I think this is where a lot of training is going to go in the future, because particularly in this COVID environment where we can't do a lot of role plays and simulations face-to-face. You don't want to be hiring a lot of people to come in and, you know, yell and scream at your face and spit all over you. It's nice to have something that's been recorded where you can be immersed in that, whether they're yelling at the camera or whether you get to witness a vignette taking place before you.
Mm.
Yeah, I think that's amazing, mate. So, and again, you would put them in those headsets for a little while, run a scenario or a couple of scenarios past them, and then you would start to pull apart the learning outcomes out of that.
Yeah. So if we really want to ramp up the pressure,
yep,
we'll have everyone go through by watching the video at the same time.
Yep.
Goggles come off. In front of them then is a series of questions.
Yep.
On a piece of paper that's being presented whilst they've had the goggles on. Silence. Everybody has to commit an answer to what they've seen, interpreted, understood.
Yep.
On a piece of paper. And then as a facilitator, we have now Mary's answer that's not diluted and changed because John has just told her the rest of the room what he would have done.
Yes, which happens, doesn't it?
Of course. Yeah, and that's where quite often as facilitators, we sort of forget that the first person's under pressure, but second and third get the easy job.
That's right.
Just summarising all the good parts of what Mary said.
That's right. I remember years ago, long before we realised how problematic this idea was, but we would have run armed robbery training. So when I first started my company, there was three of us. And we were hired by some taverns and pubs who were, because of pokies and stuff, who were likely to be subjected to armed robberies. So they said, could you do some training? So yeah, no worries at all. So we put together this fairly hard-hitting but rather dodgy program where I would stand up the front in a suit. And then suddenly one of my colleagues would come bursting in a balaclava and overalls with a fake shotgun and hold me up. Yeah, yelling and screaming and swearing and all of that. But there were a couple of occasions where the audience reacted in fairly sort of unpredictable ways.
Yeah,
we had people drop down to the ground and were crawling under tables and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
and so we were bits of cowboys in those days. And I remember later on we had a bit of a meeting and we were like, what if somebody, you know, actually has a heart attack or something because of our training? Is our insurance going to cover this? And so we started to peg it back from there. But what we did notice was, because we did exactly what you were saying, we went around with paper and pen and we said, describe that guy now. Describe what he said, what happened, at what time did it all happen. And the amount of variety in the responses was extraordinary.
Mm.
That the guy was 6'7" and, you know, really lean, or the guy was 5'7" and really muscular, and the guy was, he had some sort of accent. Nah, he sounded really Aussie. And then he was carrying a rifle. It was a shotgun. It was a sawn-off shotgun. He had a pistol in each hand. It was extraordinary. So you put people under distress, and the stuff that came out of their fight or flight brain was amazing.
That's why we've got to do it, for real, though. Which is why we do those simulations out here.
Yeah, and I love it. I love the whole idea. And I can't help but imagine that if there are people listening to this that are just from that very white-collar or very first-world background who have never really been tested, they must be going, actually, you know what I want to do?
Give it a crack.
I want to give it a crack. I want to go out there. I want to be chased by dogs. I want to be shot at. Just to know what that feels like.
And if you're feeling like that, first thing, go to a psychologist.
Because you've got issues. Yes, that's a really good point. But I do think that there are people who would know if it's a simulation. I do want to be tested. And I think that, you know, they could do a lot worse than getting in touch with you and organising the type of training that you provide, mate.
Yeah, thank you very much.
How do people get in touch with you then if they want to, if anybody's heard and they think, I've got to follow up?
Yeah, well, we've got a website. So that's www.globalfrontline.com.au.
Globalfrontline, all one word.
Yep, oneword.com.au. Welcome to go on there and check out what we've got. There's a number of videos and stuff to demonstrate some of the stuff we've talked about.
Great.
And then come directly to me on my number, 0400 300 786, or drop me an email at squiz@globalfrontline.com.au.
Squeeze it, drop. All right. So I hope you all heard that. So, mate, there's some amazing information, and good on you for an amazing life, and for converting that into something that's going to be incredibly useful for people and organisations. It's been a pleasure having you on the podcast.
Yeah. Thanks, mate. Thanks for having me.
Good on you, folks. Thanks for joining us. Take care for now. Bye.